Chapter 5. When she returned to the palace, Cressa had no chance to attend to Cerulea's distress, because numerous clerks and two ladies-in-waiting besieged her, the former wanting her approval of various documents, the latter the opportunity to show themselves essential. She allowed herself to be led to the administration salon and seated herself at a generously sized table. A servant poured her a glass of wine while Cressa worked her way through the matters presented to her, distracted by her lady's commentary and their half-successful, half-irritating efforts to prove their worth. Cressa had never learned how to use the ladies-in-waiting efficiently, because she refused to appreciate the necessity of keeping on top of court rumours. She hated having these attendants bobbing around her and suffered them with ill grace, which made their days difficult and made her feel guilty and churlish.
"Let me blot that before you get ink on your cuff, Your Majesty," offered Duchette Lumetta.
Cressa found Lumetta particularly suffocating, but she was Councillor Latley's kinswoman. Lady Fania had picked up a report on the grain yield from Prairie Vale, her home duchy.
"These figures look low to me," she commented.
Wondering whether Fania was being helpful or deliberately sowing discord, Cressa said,
"Good to know. I will have the bushel count rechecked."
Turning to the clerk, she asked,
"Are we done now? That's everything that can't wait another day?"
Receiving their assent, she addressed Lumetta and Fania.
"Ladies, you are also dismissed for today."
"But, Your Majesty, wouldn't you like us to dine with you?" asked Lumetta. "I heard the juiciest story today."
"Might I suggest," Fania began.
"Ladies,"
Cressa interrupted.
"Sometimes I need solitude just to think. You may attend me tomorrow."
Accompanied only by Shield Branwise, she walked through the building to the Royal Library and bid Branwise fetch Sewell. Her chronicler rushed to greet her, the key of his office swinging round his neck on its golden chain.
"You were right," she said. "I need to consult the volumes of other enchanters. The sooner the better."
Once inside, he swiftly lit lanterns. The library was situated on the ground floor of a corner turret, bookshelves stretched up for two stories, separated by window slits. One large window, it faced west, consisted of two panes of glass, with water continually, silently running between them. A waterfall trapped inside a window. The water inside the glass did not add moisture to the room full of the most precious records of the realm. In the afternoon light, the sunset waterfall refracted pink and orange hues. Now, however, because the sun had fallen behind the foothills, the swirling water caught just a hint of the lantern gleams. The Queen's Chronicles stood bound in red velvet, bolstered by filigreed bracing. As Sewell laid them out for her, Cressa looked back and forth between them, cross-checking one story against another. Sewell watched her closely, but instead of pestering her, he merely noticed when she needed more light and patiently held the lantern closer to the pages covered with beautiful but fading script. When she let the cover of the last volume slap closed, Sewell winced at her less than gentle handling of his treasures.
"It has been some weeks, Your Majesty, since you favoured me with your thoughts. Might you have a moment now?"
Chroniclers held a specific function in Weirendale. The brothers and sisters of sorrow chose a person from their order based upon his or her meticulous attention to detail. Sewell's life work lay in compiling The Reign of Queen Cressa. Like previous chroniclers, he would intermix pages devoted to public records or witnesses' testimony to her deeds with sheets dictated by the liege herself. Cressa felt pressed for time, but also duty-bound to leave for the future some intimation of her present predicament. Sewell could write as fast as she could speak, so for several moments she chose her words with care as his quill flowed across a page. Cressa waited until the quill stopped scratching.
"Sewell," she mused, "if I were to dismiss one of my counsellors, could I appoint you instead?"
"Your Majesty, I would serve you in any manner you requested, although chroniclers know precious little about daily political issues. Our expertise lies in the past. But if you mean to ask if chroniclers have, in Weir history, ever sat on a circle council, this occurred only once, to my knowledge, in the reign of Queen Simina the Proud, when Simina beheaded all of her circle and then needed to form a temporary replacement."
"Beheaded? Not a happy precedent."
"They had been plotting against her, and at this time the Rothers were mounting raiding parties against coastal villages. She had to present herself as indisputably in charge."
"Should I behead anyone who is rude to me?"
"I'm not certain, Your Majesty," Sewell weighed his words, "that beheadings work to win the love of the people."
"Did my mother ever have enemies killed?" Cressa asked.
"Domestic adversaries?"
"Yes."
"Not to my knowledge,"
he answered.
"None are recorded in The Life of Queen Katrina by Roatag, and Roatag was most scrupulous."
"But then my mother wouldn't have needed to. Everyone was afraid of her."
Sewell only nodded. He didn't need to add, "And no one is afraid of you," because they both knew this to be true. Cressa sighed and nodded a farewell. As Cressa left the library, Shield Bramwai shadowed her one step behind when she headed toward the front of the palace and the formal double staircase that led to the royal chambers. Ahead of her, Cressa spied a blue cloak and called out, "Captain Clemson!" The leader of her personal guard, a square-faced man with light grey eyes, froze halfway up the staircase and turned around.
"Your Majesty?"
"I wish you to put one of the catamounts on patrol in the royal wing tonight, and continue until I tell you otherwise."
"Do you know of some threat?"
Clemson's body tensed, and his hand instinctively sought his scabbard.
"No, this is just a precaution. A diplomatic argument has raised tensions."
"Oh, then possibly just doubling your shields would suffice. To be frank, Your Majesty, being around the mountain lions makes the men nervous. They weigh as much as a man, and they can take down a buck solo."
"I understand that disquiet, Captain. But what is special about catamounts is that they can't be bribed or threatened. They live for their loyalty to the line of Nargis queens."
"I can assure you that all 24 of your shields have been handpicked and tested. They are steadfast. I have personally investigated each."
"Captain, I intend no slur. I am sure the Queen's shield is all that I wish and more. I've just been reading some bloody bits of history. Please indulge me in this."
"To follow your commands is not an indulgence, Your Highness. 'Tis my duty and my pleasure."
Captain Clemson made a stiff bow and strode off to get one of the four great cats from the throne room. If the catamounts knew a court officer, and if he addressed them with the ritualistic phrase, "The Nargis Queen desires," they might, or might not, obey a request of this ilk. If they didn't comply with Clemson, Cressa would have to gather her courage to entreat them herself.
Cressa continued to the Princella's suite.
These had been her rooms until her mother died and the rooms had been converted back into a nursery. Her portraits of her father and half-brothers and the landscape painting of a typical Lortha windswept beach at sunset no longer hung in these rooms. Sometimes she missed her other homeland, another of the great powers, yet a chilly clime, where Tidewater Keep, situated on a seaside cliff, always smelled of brine. Once, Cressa's collection of seashells had been propped beside the Princella's lullaby, the open rivulet of water, about knee-high, that coursed along one wall, tiled to look like a rushing stream. At the present time, following Cerulea's wishes, the rooms boasted a colourful stencil of all the beasts of the realm. The stencil, however, was superfluous, since the chambers burst with a throng of live dogs and cats. Indeed, Cressa had to nudge them with her knees to make the waves part. While Nana tidied up the day room, Cerulea, dressed in her nightshift with her blue hair in a sleeping snood, sat in the window embrasure. From the looks of the matter, she was teaching one of her cats to ride on the back of one of the dogs, like a rider on a horse.
"Mama," she cried, "you're so late. The moons have already climbed high, and I've been waiting to talk to you."
"Now, dearest," Cressa kissed her brow, "my day has been busy. Yet I did come to fetch you from West Garden. Into bed now, and I'll chat with you a while. Nana, feel free to get yourself some supper while I sit with her." Her daughter obediently bounded into her four-poster bed and pulled the feather-stuffed quilt up to her chin as Cressa pushed the curtains aside and sat on the edge. But as soon as Nana left the room, her daughter turned on her fiercely.
"Mama, why did you enchant Persia and her parents? I didn't want you to do that."
"Several reasons. The most important was to protect them. You know the throne has enemies. I thought they would be safer if they couldn't talk about their afternoon with us." This took the force out of her daughter's complaint. Cerulea's tone instantly turned from accusation to grief.
"But the Tanager chose her to be my friend, my best friend."
"Did he know?"
"You must believe me about this."
Cressa said noncommittally, thinking about her daughter's lively imagination as she stroked her hair.
"So how will I see her again if she doesn't remember me and she sailed away?"
"Perchance, when this trouble with Oromondo is over, we'll invite her and her family to visit."
"Mama, could Persia be my lady-in-waiting, like Lady Fania is yours, and live at the castle?"
"We'll see."
"How long will this we'll see last, Mama? I don't want to visit Duchess Latley's grandniece again."
"Why not?
She's nothing like Persia. She's stupid and mean. She pinched me. Look."
Cerulea kicked the quilt down and pulled up her nightshift and pointed out each little bruise mark darkening her brown thigh. "How did this happen?"
"Yesterday at mid-meal, she pinched me under the table because everyone was admiring my hair."
"Why didn't you tell me yesterday?"
"The marks didn't show until today."
"Sounds like an envious little beast." Having duly admired each bruise, Cressa tucked the quilt back up around the girl. "What did you do after she pinched you?"
"I moved my chair so that the leg came down on her boot. Then I said, 'Did I hurt you? I'm so sorry.'"
Cressa exhaled to keep from laughing.
"No,
you need not visit her again."
"Good," said Cerulea, yawning. "She taught me such a funny rhyme, though. I wonder why Lady Fania never shared it with me. Do you know it?"
Cerulea sat up and sang tunefully, though she broke into giggles two-thirds of the way through.
"Rotha red upon each head, Lotha grey they do display. In days of old, eager was gold. In years back, wise wore lilac. Alpy yellow shows your fellow. Isle's bright green could be foreseen. Melly plum to hail your chum. Oro white they hold upright. Pellish pink because they stink.
Where amber is the grander. Precious blue for only two.
muddy brown in every town. Common brown is all around.
Gressa regretted that Cerulea had been exposed to this ditty, though she could hardly keep the girl in ignorance forever. Although all peoples the known world over shared a skin colour of wheat brown and eyebrows of a darker walnut hue, whether from bloodlines or diet, or, if legends were accurate, as a mark of their spirit's favour, in olden times, citizens of many countries displayed a characteristic hair colour. But the more their people travelled and intermarried, and the more foodstuffs traded freely, the less these colours appeared. Brown hair of varying shades and textures had long become the norm. Some people had haphazard streaks of their country's original old colour. Nowadays, polite people considered it old-fashioned and narrow-minded to focus on old colour, and deeply offensive to imply that one hue was preferable to another. However, conservative families, like Duchess Latley's, still fixated on tracing their pure lineage, and they held on to old colour requirements in arranging marriages. "I don't approve of that song," said Cressa. "I don't want you to repeat it. Brown hair is just as nice as any other colour. Think of it. Persia's hair is brown, and Duchess Latley's is full-on amber. So colour of hair means nothing. Latley's a fool and a snob. She disapproves of your father because of his hair."
"My father is 100 times better than her,"
Cerulea protested.
"Indeed."
Cressa pulled her daughter closer, enjoying the smell of the elderberry soap that Nanny used to scrub her, and listening to the soothing murmur of the Princella's lullaby. Meanwhile, Nana herself returned from the kitchens carrying a supper tray for herself. Nana had a snug room of her own off of the Princella's bedchamber where she would eat in front of her fire. Cressa nodded to her as she passed through. Nana had always held a special place in her heart. One of the smaller dogs jumped up on the bed and pawed vigorously at the quilt, succeeding in pushing its slender muzzle underneath. It crept beneath and snuggled next to Cerulea. Cressa didn't particularly like dogs and would never have wanted one in her own bed, but her daughter clutched the creature against her chest and yawned again.
"Good night, Cerulea. May Mother Moon and Daughter Moon watch over your dreams."
Cressa kissed her daughter, lingering, wanting to draw the moment out, and then drew closed the bed curtains, blew out the candles, and left her to sleep. Passing down the stone hallway filled with flaming torches, she saw a doubled contingent of the Queen's shield, and a catamount lying in the middle of the floor, impassively staring at her with its yellow eyes, which caught the flames and sent them back again.